Happy New Year to you.
Oh, no. Mommy, don't sing.
Good morning, diners and travelers, and indeed, happy 2018.
Just about.
It's going to be a good year, yes.
We hope.
We hope. we're going to have a little tour here in exotic places, starting with...
We're going left to right, or east, or west to east, depending on which way you like to look at it. Looking at traditional cuisines of
Istanbul,
historic lands. First of all, we have Istanbul, which has been there a good long time.
It
used to be called Constantinople, of course. And then we're heading south and a little bit to the left. That's Palestine. And then finally to India. With experts on the cuisine of all those places along the way, all of whom have produced recent books on the subject, and very knowledgeable, and you'll find them.
And beautiful photographs, too.
And a wonderful story to tell. Just the right thing to start off the year.
Okay, to start off, we're talking to Robin Eckhart of Istanbul and Beyond. You know, I really am astounded by this book. I don't think that I would have ever tackled it. Robin Eckhart did, and the photographs by her husband, David Hagerman, they're just absolutely wonderful. But I never ever understood how complicated the whole place is, Istanbul and beyond, geographically, culturally, ethnically, culinarily. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is. It's a very complex country, and I think that's what we were trying to bring home with the book is we wanted to get people beyond that idea of Turkish food as kebabs, and doners, baklava, and Turkish delight. Of course, there is that, but that's not all there is. There's so much more, and the diversity is more than even we imagined when we set out to research the book.
Yeah, that's why I said, I probably, once I realized it, wouldn't have tackled it, because it was quite an undertaking. How many years did it take for you to produce this book?
Well, we decided to do the book in around January 2011, and then between then and end of spring 2015, we spent about 16-plus months on the ground in Turkey, in Istanbul, and out east in the eastern half of the country. And when we were out east, we traveled entirely by road, so driving ourselves, and covered about 15,000 miles.
Wow.
I hope you were packing a pistol.
Yeah. No, it's very safe. Very safe country. Turkey is probably one of the most hospitable countries on earth. Turks and Kurds are so incredibly welcoming, and I've really never felt more warmth, genuine warmth and welcome than I felt when we were traveling around Turkey researching this book.
Yeah, they're not tough on women. I thought that was probably a no-no. Going there as a woman.
I have a more fundamental question. Why did you tackle Turkey and Istanbul in particular? Was there a personal reason, or?
It's a passion. David and I first visited Turkey in 1998 when we were living in Shanghai. He was working there, and I was doing dissertation research for a PhD I never finished. And we went.
Sounds
we
familiar.
Went to
I'm there too.
I think a lot of people are there.
Yeah.
We just went to Turkey kind of on a spur-of-the-moment decision. We had 3 weeks of vacation. We had frequent flyer miles, and Europe was too expensive, but we could get to Istanbul. And we spent about 3 weeks in the country, 1 week in Istanbul and 2 weeks on the road, and just fell in love with the place. After that, we moved back to the U.S., to Northern California, where we've been living before, and I started studying Turkish at UC Berkeley with coincidentally Ayla Algar, who is herself a cookbook author, a Turkish cookbook author. So it was almost kind of like, predestined or something.
It's surprising. There's so many surprises in here in the diversity. I had a Greek restaurant in Philadelphia, and our chef was from Istanbul because they were the better cooks, the Greeks said. So, he cooked Greek food. Now, from reading your book, I understand that Istanbul has sort of a melting pot of all kinds of influences.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How would you break it down, you did in your book, in terms of organization, the different culinary regions of that Turkey?
Well, we really started, I mean, Istanbul, as you said, is its own place. It's a melting pot.
That's
the former capital of the Ottoman Empire. So Istanbul food is its own thing. Once we moved out east, we really let the land guide us, because we found pretty quickly once we started traveling out there that really from the land comes the food. People eat very locally, and what they eat is determined by what is grown around them, and that is, of course, is determined by topography and climate. So as we traveled, as we were driving, I would literally be taking notes, you know, in my notebook, like, as the landscape changed and we moved from lush high plateaus in the northeast where cows graze easily, and we moved south into Van and Hakkari provinces, Kurdish provinces along the Iran and Iraqi borders, where you suddenly get, you know, very jagged, rough foothills and soaring snow-capped peaks, and in this kind of topography, really only sheep and goats can graze because cattle cannot handle that kind of topography to graze on. So, you know, I started with that. I started with how the way things looked were changing. And then, you know, I pretty quickly was able to observe that what people were eating really very closely corresponded to the way that their landscape and their climate was, in a way that we in America really can no longer imagine. You know, we are not bound by topography and climate when we choose what we eat. We can have pretty much anything, anytime.
Right.
And it's a very locavore, seasonal kind of eating, and it's not because it's trendy or hip. It's just because it's the way it's always been.
Right. Now, you have a stock in your Turkish pantry.
yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, but how did you select these? Because it depends really where you are in the country, right?
Well, because we were in so many regions, I think we've got 6 regions in addition to Istanbul, and they're all very different. And everything in the pantry, you know, if you stock your Turkish pantry according to the ingredients listed in the book, you can cook from any of these very, very diverse regions in Turkey, and you can cook Istanbul food. And I want to just kind of point out here that there are really not many ingredients, or if any ingredients, that I would call exotic. I mean, Ottolenghi has introduced us to pomegranate molasses and tahini, and you can even sometimes buy pomegranate molasses at the grocery store now. My brief from my editor was that everything needed to be purchasable online, preferably from Amazon, and everything is.
Yeah, I would think so. You reminded me of something. I'm trying to think of what it was. Something was interesting. We interviewed somebody who has a company that makes tahini. And, I mean, you always think of tahini as a standard Middle Eastern thing. And you mentioned, you touch on it in your book, that they actually, most of the tahini comes now, the seeds are grown in Africa, and that's what they do.
Right. You know, many of the seeds were grown in Syria, and for obvious reasons, there's not a lot of sesame seed production there anymore. And sesame seed, there's not tons of sesame seed production in southeastern Turkey. It used to be grown in southeastern Turkey, but you've got a lot of cotton farms there now, irrigated from the Atatürk Dam. So that kind of crop has replaced sesame, and so now most of the seeds do come from Ethiopia. But people who make tahini say some of the best sesame seeds come from Africa.
This company, I can't remember, it's called Zoom, I think. The seeds are grown in Africa, and then the product is made in Israel, and then
I thought it was an Israel connection.
Yeah, that's the connection. But can you? I want to say, by the way, I really got inspired by these recipes because they sound so delicious, and one of the ones I'm planning on making, is the stuffed mussels. I used to make that all the time. I'm reading your recipes, and you've taken these recipes and you've also lightened them up and modernized some of the techniques. I know you said that, what was it, that you found a better way of opening of muscles, was it? Or was it?
Right. It was kind of quickening the browning
of the onions right.
for making the filling.
Kenji's wonderful.
Kenji also method with the baking soda. I tried not to change recipes too much, and most recipes I didn't change at all. But you know, I know enough to know that very few American cooks are going to want to spend or even have the time to spend 2 hours. Slowly browning onions and making a filling for mussels. So if I can use a proven technique and Kenji Alt's technique with the baking soda and quickening the browning of the onions, if that works, then I'm happy to use it. And I don't think that this recipe is from one of Istanbul's last Armenian delis, and the owner, Ari Terzioğlu, gave me his family's recipe. He might not approve, but I think he would understand.
You mentioned that when he promised you this recipe, and then the chef blocked your view so you couldn't get it, and he gave it to you. That was my next question, is how did you finagle all these recipes? You talk about cooking with different people and making noodles and so forth. How did that all happen?
I would say that the recipes were secondary to the experience. We never set out on a trip, with me saying, okay, I've got a list of recipes and I've got to get them. We set out on a trip and number of trips. And it was about the experience of being there. It was about meeting people. It was about spending time with people and learning about their lives and what they grow and what they make and what they cook. And the recipes sort of came naturally. In some cases, I cooked with people and I got the recipe that way. In some cases, I watched them cook. In some cases, I just ate at their table, in their dining room or in their house. In some cases, I was at a market and I saw an interesting ingredient and I just asked the ladies, because it's usually ladies who are selling it, how do you make, what do you do with this? And they would give me, something of a recipe. We spent a lot of time in traditional wood-fired bakeries in eastern Turkey called Furin. And these are still, in addition to being bread bakeries, they're community ovens.
Yes.
So people will bring in a dish and they'll pay the baker 30 cents, the equivalent of 30 U.S. cents, to tend their dish in the oven, and then they'll come and pick it up and take it home. And so in some cases, I was able to talk to people. I was able to taste their finished dishes. They tell me how they made it. And in Turkey, recipes are never like cups and teaspoons. It's like, add flour till it feels good.
Yeah, right.
And knead the dough till it feels like your earlobe, that kind of thing.
My family recipes are like that. They say, add a jar of such and such, but they don't tell you what's
right. Add a teacup.
Yeah.
And then I just try and recreate the flavors I remember in my home kitchen.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the interesting, I knew nothing about this. Is it Hatay province?
Hatay province, yes.
Hatay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really unusual, isn't it?
It's Hatay is that bit of land. If you go to the farthest eastern part of Turkey's Mediterranean coast, spit of land that comes down, Hatay is bordered on the Mediterranean by the Mediterranean and by Syria, and it actually was part of Syria until the early 20th century. So much of the food there is very Levantine. It is what probably most Americans, would think of when you think of Syrian or Levantine or Middle Eastern food. Dips and lots of dips and meze and very spicy olive oil, pomegranate molasses, chilies, that sort of thing.
Yeah, chili cheese, and that's a showstopper, isn't it?
It's a really good, that's a really good cheese. I recommend people try that recipe. They'll be pretty amazed, I think, by the flavors.
Tell me some of the others, like you'd point people to special recipes in the book. What are some of the ones that you felt were just sort of definitive?
Definitive and delicious. I would say it's fall, it's autumn, it's pumpkin season. Make the meatballs with pumpkin and spice butter.
I saw
from
that.
Don in Hakkari province.
And I wasn't sure about that. I mean, I looked at it.
I've done that in a few demos, and people go crazy for it. It's finished with this butter in which you sizzle chili and purple basil, and my substitute for purple basil is dried Italian basil with ground anise, and the scent is heavenly as it rises from the sizzling butter and you pour it over your finished meatballs and pumpkin. It's fabulous.
Well, you make it sound very good.
It's really good. It's perfect for this time of year, too.
The one that I loved is the turmeric-scented lamb and chickpea stew.
That is really a favorite of mine.
Peter's going to make that one, I know.
It's really good. It's also perfect for this time of year, and it's pretty low maintenance. You know, you just pop it in the oven and let it cook away, check it once, and yeah, that's a good one. That's from the Northeast. That's an Azerbaijani dish, actually.
Uh-huh.
I really love, you know, this is kind of simple, but I love a good grilled cheese sandwich, and I think that the best grilled cheese sandwiches in the world are in Istanbul.
I thought that was amazing. I never expected that.
Yeah, no, it's just kind of so everywhere that I think tourists overlook it. But it's just a part of Istanbul life is grabbing a grilled cheese on the go. And I included a recipe for kind of a grilled cheese with everything.
Yeah, but it really does. Just run through the ingredients that you, on your preference for grilled cheese.
So you've got a nice mild melting cheese. You want obviously good, bread that's not going to break up in the, you know, in the pan. And, I've got roasted green chilies in there. I've got, you want a nice slather of good tomato paste or good Turkish hot red pepper paste. Pickle, a slice of pickle. I think I've got, some tomato in there too. And, I mean, if you go to these places in Istanbul called buffets, they're convenience kiosks, they'll have a whole array of ingredients that you can choose from. Chopped olives, mixed vegetables, roasted eggplant, roasted potato even. And you can have 20 ingredients on your grilled cheese if you want.
Sounds like fun. Now, there's a huge variety of breads that featured in the region. And I came across this one. It's a yeast bread stuffed with Swiss chard and herbs. And my family was Sicilian. And there's a bread there that's like this called scotcha, except it also has cheese in it.
Oh, I never heard of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Anyhow, but this reminded me of it because, you won't find it because it's, there's another scotcha, which isn't the same thing at all. It's one of those things where people gave names to family dishes and, you know, if you don't have the recipes from your family, you don't come across them, but you might be able to find it. But anyhow, it's also a yeast bread.
And, it's very interesting.
Yeah. So, and they use, whatever they substituted for the original cheese plus Parmesan. It's a meltable cheese and then you put Parmesan in it and olive oil, salt and pepper, and then you stuff the bread. So, but anyhow.
Oh, sounds delicious.
It is fabulous. It's a complete meal. So the other thing you have plenty of, you have lots of flatbreads and so on in here, lots of fun with that. And then, what about with all these noodles?
Yeah, I mean, people tend to, if you think pasta and turkey, people think, oh, Turks eat manta, which are those little dumplings stuffed with meat that are usually in a yogurt sauce. And that's it. But actually, noodles really are a big part of Turkish life. In the Northeast, they eat something called hangal, which are these wonderful, silky, floppy handkerchief noodles.
Oh, yes.
In the book, I saw some with butter and blue cheese because they do make their own blued string cheese there.
Blue, that's weird. I mean, of course, I know they make string cheese, but I never knew they made blue cheese. And
Well, I mean, they basically take fresh string cheese and stuff it in the hide of a goat or usually a goat and then put it away in the cellar for 6 months, and when it comes out, it's blue, and it tastes like a sharp, very dry Roquefort. It's really lovely. So they'll put that, cut that up and put it on noodles with tons of butter because it's a dairy country. Another thing that people do actually all over the East is they make noodles in the autumn to last for winter. And there's a photo in the opening part of the book of a woman hanging freshly made, right. You know, 3-yard-long noodles over a clothesline, and those are to dry in the sun and then to be taken to the fir and to be toasted. And then they'll just be stored and eaten all winter with, you know, maybe just with butter or maybe tossed with green lentils or maybe baked with butter and cheese. Noodles are a big part of the Turkish diet, and most people don't read that.
Yes.
Know that.
Yeah, I was amazed, really, yeah. We were trying, Peter and I were trying, we interviewed somebody who, in this book, they had the women out with these little portable tables on, set up on the sidewalk making the noodles, and we can't remember where it was.
Right, and also they used those round tables to make gözleme, those lovely super thin flatbreads that they fill with spinach and, you know, white salty cheese and cook on a griddle. Delicious.
Well, I mean, I think this is a major accomplishment, and you will compliment your husband. How did he approach the photography? It's wonderful photographs.
Well, I think, you know, with most cookbooks, photographs are on-location photographs, if they are in the book at all, are an after-the-fact sort of thing. So the writer, you know, and maybe the editor, you know, put their heads together and come up with a shot list. Maybe the writer goes with the photographer back to the location, and the photographer only has a week to 10
right,
days to
exactly.
capture the essence of the book. But David and I were together for 16 months. He worked on his own quite often, and so he really had a chance to really to go beyond in capturing really the essence of what these cuisines are about and to portray in a way that wouldn't be possible in 10 days, perhaps, how deeply tied to the land and the climate these cuisines are.
He probably shares my secret,
which
with,
is
with photographs. Take a hell of a lot of them.
Yes, I think he said about 100,000.
when in doubt, shoot another dozen.
Exactly. And another thing I learned is that the photographer likes some time alone. So he would. You know, we worked exclusively together in the beginning, and then after a couple months, we got into a routine where he would go out at first light in the morning on his own and come back, and then we'd work together for the rest of the day.
Yeah. Peter's specialty was sunsets. I don't know how many times we've been
sunsets,
in a restaurant.
Sunsets and sunrises.
Yeah, but we'd go to a restaurant, and he kept running out.
Right.
Yeah, I captured it every 5 minutes for about 2 hours.
Yeah, we just kind of gave up on eating dinner a lot of the time. So,
the result of that was a photograph which was printed in the in one of the newspapers here in Pittsburgh, and it, from one side of the front page to the other.
It was nice.
Oh,
was my photograph.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
That is a dream.
It was worth all the trouble.
Does Anya von Bresenen still live in Turkey part-time?
I believe she does, yes.
No, I don't think she's written a book on Turkish cuisine, has she?
No, but I think she's working on a book that might involve Turkey.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, her latest one is Cuban.
Well,
Cuban? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, yours came out first, so well done. Congratulations to your husband too. Congratulations
Thank
to both
you so
of
much.
You, both of you for still being married after all this time.
Yes, they said. We are still married. We didn't kill each other, so that's an accomplishment in and of itself.
Yes, well, we are too. So.
Thank you so
Robin,
much.
Robin, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today
thank
on
you
the
so
menu.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It was really fun talking to you.
And you too.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye-bye. And we'll be right back, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, sweetheart, who's next?
Well, next up is Reem Kassis, who's going to talk to us about her book, The Palestinian Table, which is everybody's so interested in the Middle East these days. And this book is a real revelation. Reem Kassis, you have a very interesting background and an interesting subject, The Palestinian Table. We read a lot about Palestine. Palestine and Jerusalem. You were, well, tell us your background. I mean, you come from a really interesting mashup culturally, don't you?
I do, yes. I was born in Jerusalem, but my parents are from two very different parts of the country. So my father is from the north, my mother is more from the central part of the country, and they're actually also different religions. So my father is a Christian, my mother is a Muslim, and then I grew up in Jerusalem. So as you can imagine, it was a complete mishmash of culture, religion, foods, etc. And, I mean, growing up, part of me took it for granted, part of me didn't appreciate it, and I think it was once I left that I got to see all those things in perspective and realize just how much they contributed now to the person I was.
Yeah. Now, the country you're referring to is Palestine.
Well, yes. I mean, we're Palestinians. Technically, my father's village is in Israel, so is my mother's. Jerusalem, obviously, disputed. But whenever I talk about food, whenever I talk about culture, I'm referring to Palestinian food and culture. And
yeah, you can't really separate the two, can you? I mean, it's one of the points you make in your book is that it's all about culture, family, connection, hospitality. Mm-hmm. That's what really sets Palestinian cuisine apart, right?
It is. I think so. And actually, someone just asked me this question recently. They said, what is the Palestinian table? And I think they were expecting me to summarize some foods. And I said, you know what? What combines what unites the Palestinian table across the world, whether we are living, you know, in our land, whether it's under occupation or whether we are living abroad by choice or by circumstance, I think what really unites Palestinians everywhere and our Palestinian table is this notion of home that many of us aspire to, and also the sense of generosity with which we share our food and our culture with others.
Yeah.
I think I wanted to get that point across with the book because
there's so much
focus on our politics that people forget sometimes that there is a much deeper and richer culture behind those issues.
We had an art project, if you can believe this, a graduate art project out of Carnegie Mellon University called Conflict Kitchen.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and well, it's defunct at this point. I think it's been taken over by the larger world. But for about 5 or 6 years, they had different restaurants, like walk-up counters, where they would feature a rotating list of countries that the United States was in conflict with.
Yeah,
and of course, Palestine was one of them.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, it was wonderful. Project. I mean, it really was,
I can see why, because when you're immersed in a conflict, it seems to eclipse everything else.
Exactly.
And sometimes I think the best way to get your story across is to talk about different topics, to talk about our food and our culture and get people to recognize us for something else, to know us as a people, as a culture, as a history and tradition and as a part of our food, and maybe then our conflict can be understood through a different lens, a different perspective, and who knows? Maybe I'm too hopeful, but maybe something will come out of it.
if people really thought about it, Israelis, Hebrews, call them what you like in Israel, they're really Palestinians anyway, most of them.
Well, I mean, far back in history, we're all the same people.
That's their homeland, right?
Yeah, it depends how far you go back, but at the end of the day, I mean, if you stretch back into history, who knows? Everybody is related in some way.
Now you were very fortunate. You had three women in your life that were all amazing cooks, two grandmothers and a mother. I mean, they were like the best cooks in the whole, wherever they were, in that village or city or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And people used to be. But now, so you were accustomed to really great food.
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it.
You didn't know it. You don't appreciate it until
exactly.
I mean,
you don't appreciate it till it's gone.
It's gone. I mean, I'm lusting after.
That's in a song somewhere, right?
Yeah. I'm lusting after a fig cookie that was traditional Sicilian Christmas cookies.
Mm.
And I got our local public television chef interested in recreating it. But he found out, and we were going to do it, but he found out it took 2 days to make.
Oh, God, yes. There are so many of our foods as well. I mean, I don't even know how my grandmothers and my mother used to just, they had the patience. And, of course, life was different back then. The pace was slower. But much of our food also used to take a lot of time to make, and everything was done by hand, and there were no kitchen gadgets that made everything easier. But I tried in this book to make it fit for someone like me who's a mother of two in a very fast-paced world. So
yes, and you were lured into the kitchen almost against your intent, right?
Yes and no. I mean, look, I grew up, like you said, I mentioned this, I grew up eating amazing food, and I took it for granted. If anything, I also kind of grew up thinking, I don't want to end up in the kitchen. I want to go out into the world, and I want to show that I can do something different.
You're highly educated.
Yes. So, I have 4 university degrees, 2 graduate degrees, and, before leaving Jerusalem, someone had quipped to my father, he said, you're going to really send her abroad and pay all that money, just what, so she ends up in the kitchen, like Arab women anyway, and of course, we laughed it off in my family because we knew that that was a very backward way of thinking and by no means the way most Palestinians think, but still, even the fact that this mindset existed kind of pushed me to prove that no, it is not every woman's destiny to end up in the kitchen, but I guess sometimes you do find your destiny on the very road you take to avoid it. And in my case, it took me years and years to realize that the kitchen is actually food, is a very powerful medium with which to achieve things.
Yeah, and your husband helped, right?
Your
husband helped for you to identify what you wanted to do.
I think he helped put things in perspective. He helped me overcome some of the mental roadblocks I had to this career path, if you will. But I think, with time, with maturity, with all these associated things that happen, once you have kids and you get married and you move on, I started to realize that I do, going back into the kitchen is not a sentence like I imagine. And you mentioned that I was fortunate, and part of me felt, because I'm fortunate enough to leave, I want to give back to my people. And never did I imagine that I would give back through food. But now I'm seeing that by documenting our culture and our culinary traditions, I am, in fact, giving back to my people in a much better way than I could have through the other career I was pursuing prior. So it's funny the way things work out sometimes.
Yes. I had a laugh, though, about how hard it was getting measurements for the recipe.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Yes, I remember that. I specifically remember it was the fenugreek cake that we got in a fight over. I said, I need the exact measurement.
Yes.
And she goes, but it's not good. I tried it and it doesn't come out the same. So finally I sat with her and she would use her hand. I would take it out with a spoon and I would dump it in her hand and she would sprinkle it and then I would measure whatever was left. Eventually we figured it out, down to the gram of exactly how much you needed and it's perfect. And now she calls me and she goes, Reem, can you please send me that recipe again for the cake? And I'm like, oh, so now you are using my recipe.
Now, this is dried turmeric you're talking about, right?
I know the fenugreek cake, the dessert.
Oh, fenugreek. I'm getting fenugreek and turmeric mixed up.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's turmeric in the cake as well, so you're not too far off.
good.
Well, no, I went through this with my grandmother. She began to think I was like slightly retarded because I kept wanting her to
Hold on a second. Let me interject something here because it's interesting. I just made chicken soup for the first time in this cool season. And I used the variant that we read about in was a cookbook about the Arab table, must have been, because it's called Yemeni chicken soup. And the trick ingredient in the Yemen chicken soup is turmeric.
I mean, turmeric has so many health benefits. We use it in a lot of things as well. We don't necessarily use it in our chicken soup just because of the color that it gives, but like in ma'lube, which is one of the quintessential Palestinian dishes, it's definitely the stock is flavored with turmeric.
I think it's marvelous. I made it on Monday, and I think we finished it yesterday.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
it was really good, and it got yellower and yellower as time went on.
Yeah, let me get something off the table. It's gotten even tiresome. Shakshuka is on every menu that you encounter. Why is this happening?
Look, shakshuka is actually Tunisian in origin. So even though I have a recipe in my book, I clearly mention at the beginning and I say it's of Tunisian origin, but we eat it. And my family enjoys it on many different occasions, whether for breakfast or actually one of the holidays, we always have it as well. And so that's why it's found its place into the book. But I think it's just people love eggs, and it's a very unique way to make eggs. It's quite easy.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, you know, it's become very common across restaurants. And even though some people might call it Israeli, some people might call it whatever they want, at the end of the day, it's actually a dish of Tunisian origin. So I don't think any of us can lay claim to it, but it's a fantastic dish, and I think
it's very
part of
popular,
food is about
yeah.
sharing. It's not about ownership, per se. It's about sharing your food with others and enjoying it, and if it does that, then I don't think any of us have a problem with it.
Now, is this the poached eggs with a spicy
with
tomato
tomatoes.
Sauce?
Yes,
because
exactly.
we have a very good friend who's in New Zealand, but with restaurants in New Zealand and in London, and he says the one dish that has been on his restaurant menu since they opened was what he calls Turkish eggs.
Yes, the yogurt with the poached eggs and the chili infused butter.
But his has the spicy tomato sauce in it too.
The
only additional ingredient, I guess, is the yogurt.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I've had them; they're quite good.
Well, let's get down to like how is a Palestinian food different from, say,
Lebanese
or Israeli or just general Middle Eastern? What are distinguishing characteristics besides communal eating and dips?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, if we're going to compare the cuisines of the Middle East, if you're going to look at the Levant versus the Gulf, obviously there are many differences, much of which is influenced by the geography. You know,
yes.
the Gulf is closer to the Indian subcontinent, and you can see those influences in their food. The Levant, you don't see that much. Now, once you get down to the Levant, to Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and Palestine, and I think I briefly mentioned this in the book, but it's hard to delineate the exact origin of every single dish that we enjoy. I mean, we were a single entity under the Ottoman Empire, and the geographic landscape there extends to pre-Ottoman times even. So naturally, we enjoy many of the same foods. We use many of the same ingredients that are local to the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
My great-great-grandmother is Syrian, and I talk about this in the book. So she brought a recipe with her from Syria when she married my great-great-grandfather, and things moved around that way, and that's why you find a lot of shared dishes. Naturally, when, you know, borders come up and people mix less and less, the nuances become more obvious. And I think that, look, when you use the same ingredients, what ends up happening at the end of the day is you either have a few ingredients that are different in certain places, and then the rest becomes the way you combine and cook these ingredients. And I think to answer your question in the easiest way possible is just simply to give you a few examples of dishes that are purely or
that's what I
just
wanted.
Made in. So, okay, let's say maftoul, for example. This is similar to couscous, which is eaten all over North Africa. But the way it's done in Palestine is done only there. So it's bulgur grains, and around it you roll them in whole wheat flour, and you end up with these caviar-sized pearls. Now, this particular, I guess, ensuing grain, or whatever you want to call it, it's similar to pasta. It's done just that way with Palestinians, and the way it's cooked as well is not done that way in any of the other countries in the Levant.
I mean, is it more like Israeli couscous as we know it?
It's smaller than Israeli couscous. Israeli couscous is closer to something that the Lebanese eat called mughrabi, which is larger in size. So maftoul is actually very small. It's between Israeli couscous and between the North African couscous in terms of size. Another dish, for example, is ma'loube. Ma'loube, at the end of the day, it's rice and fried vegetables, normally cauliflower or aubergines, cooked with either chicken or meat. Everybody uses these ingredients, right? But just the way they are cooked, the way that you layer the pot and the spices that you use and the way you flip it, et cetera, that is a very traditional Palestinian dish that other countries in the Levant don't necessarily cook.
Now you have frika in there, which we love.
Sorry,
we love frika, but we understand that it was originally developed in the land between the rivers.
Yeah, so frika again. You're right. It's very local, but it's also enjoyed in Egypt as well. But it's a native grain to the Levant. But I do think we all eat it, probably more so maybe in Palestine, but I know Syrians enjoy it as well.
Yeah, I thought I associate it with Syrians. And the funny thing is, the guy who commercialized it, that we interviewed years ago, the first time I saw it anywhere, was Australian.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you get the most random products being distributed by so many different people, and I think it's beautiful that it exposes different cultures to our food. I mean, I've never had a problem with anyone eating our food and sharing in it, and I mean, I generally try to avoid the political discussions, but even when it comes to Israeli cuisine, I've been asked this question so many times. You know, what's the difference between Israeli and Palestinian, or why do Palestinians get upset about Israelis eating their food? And that's actually not the case. Palestinians are not upset about Israelis enjoying our food.
Yeah,
and in fact, you know, many restaurants in Jerusalem are frequented by Israeli patrons. I think what bothers Palestinians because of the heated political issues that we have is when these foods, their origin is not recognized. And this issue happens much more abroad. I think in the foodie community in the Middle East, this is almost a non-issue because everybody knows what dishes originated where and from who. But when you come abroad and certain things are marketed, let's say, as Israeli, Palestinians are upset because they say you are, in a way, trying to deny the origin or deny that we existed, but it is not a problem of sharing food. So I think, you know, like I said, Middle Eastern cuisines in general are about sharing. And
well, I can tell you this, that with a Sicilian background, I can tell you that your stuffed aubergine is exactly the way my family made it.
I'm not surprised. I mean, like I said, it's similar ingredients. We all use vegetables. We all use meats. We use pine nuts and grains and whatnot, and it ends up being the way maybe you spice it or the way you cook it. But
well, here's
really,
something I want desperately is this fenugreek semolina cake.
Yes, it is very good, but it is very much a you love it or you hate it kind of cake. It's a very strong flavor. I love it.
Yeah,
I
it sounds like my kind of thing. I love that.
Yes. It's quite good. I would make it.
Well, I don't bake. Do you think I could make that?
I think so. I mean, look, Palestinian food is quite forgiving, and I did want to be very exact in the measurements for the book because not everyone might want to experiment when cooking. They might want to know exact measurements, but most of these dishes, it's not like you're making, you know, two pastry where if you miss one egg, you've destroyed what you're making, you know.
It's not
French
pastry, right?
Exactly. You know, you can give or take. The texture might be slightly thinner or thicker, sweeter, less sweet, but
I have a question. We are crazed over za'atar.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, za'atar, you buy it in a spice jar.
It's not good.
I always thought it was like a mixture of herbs. And
mm-hmm.
And you're telling me that there's a plant.
Yes.
It's called za'atar, and then you use the leaves?
Exactly. So this always used to also frustrate me when I came across it, is za'atar is not a mixture of herbs. Za'atar is the name of a plant that grows wild in the Levant. And what we do, we normally forage for it in the mountains. We take it home, we strip the leaves off the stems, and we leave them to dry. Once they've dried, we grind it with some sesame seeds, and then we mix it with whole sesame seeds, some mac, and salt. And that's what we call za'atar. That's what we use to top our flatbreads, the mena'ish. That's what we dip with olive oil and bread every morning.
Yeah, I love your breakfast. I love your father's cooking and breakfast and stuff.
Breakfast is probably my favorite meal, too, but za'atar is very special. I mean, it's delicious, but this plant is difficult to come across outside the Middle East, so I can see why it becomes a mixture of herbs abroad. Oregano is very close.
Yeah, I thought in Morocco, we've talked to people who, you know, in that part of Africa, and they use a lot of za'atar, but the main ingredient in za'atar is sumac,
which is
a different plant altogether.
Yeah, it's true. So I had a friend who gave me one once, and she called it za'atar halabi, and the main ingredient was also sumac. And if you notice in the book, on the following page, there's du'a, which people call za'atar, and that actually doesn't even have the plants or herbs in it. It's purely wheat and spices. But you go to Egypt, and then it's based on nuts, not on wheat. So as you can see, there are differences when you move across the Middle East and how certain things are prepared. But za'atar, the actual condiment originally, and the name even if you go back to biblical times, it's that plant that is native to the region.
Well, I hope to see it sometime because I have no idea.
It looks very similar to oregano in terms of looks. Even in terms of flavor, it's quite similar. Oregano is a bit stronger, a bit more bitter. But.
Well, read Cassis. The book is The Palestinian Table. And I think the time has come for home cooks to be able to make some of these. And you set out to do that very effectively in this book.
I hope so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me. It was a pleasure.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, this next book has been long anticipated, and those who are fans of Rasika, the restaurant, will love to see the inside of all these recipes and see how it's all done. And we're going to be talking to the owner, Ashok Bajaj, and the chef, Vikram Sundaram. Did I do that already? I think so.
I'm sure they will forgive me.
The real point is it's Rasika, Flavors of India, and it's spicy and wonderful.
Who do we have on the phone now, my dear?
Yeah. I have Vikram Sundaram, who is the executive chef of Rasika's.
And Ashok Bajaj.
Who? Ashok Bajaj. I'm the owner of Knightsbridge Restaurant Group,
right. Exactly.
Which also owns Rasika and Rasika West End.
Okay, let's do that again, recorded. Did you record that?
Yeah,
right?
It's recorded. Yeah, we're recording.
Oh, okay,
we're recording already.
Okay.
I wanted to kind of introduce this a little bit, if I might.
Yeah.
The book is a celebration. The book is a celebration of a job wonderfully well done by both of you gentlemen. I know you must be proud, and you have good reason to be. But we were just talking a little bit ago before we came on the air, and I said, do you remember a chef, an Indian restaurant in Washington, D.C. called Gaylord's? And they said, no. And I said, well, we finally decided it was because Gaylord's probably closed 35 years ago.
Yeah. And it was much before my time. But, you know.
The interesting question, why an Indian restaurant in Washington, D.C. after all this time?
Well, no, I opened my first restaurant, which is called the Bombay Club, 28 years ago. I moved here from London after opening the Bombay Brasserie restaurant in London. And, you know, looked at this and I said, okay, D.C. really needs a great restaurant. And that's what brings me here. And, you know, and I wanted to do my first restaurant, the food from my country, which was the Indian food. And there were not many great restaurants, let alone Indian restaurants, you know, 30 years ago. You know, of course, there was a celebrity restaurant called John Louis, and there was La Paradou and a few others.
Yeah.
You know, D.C. have changed. D.C. have dining scene have changed, and D.C. has some wonderful restaurants. So I wanted to introduce the cuisine from my homeland, which was the, you know, Indian cuisine. And then I did not open a second restaurant for a good 16 years because I felt there was no such demand for Indian food until I opened Rasika. You know, when more people were traveling to India, more people coming back and asking for, you know, different kind of Indian cuisine. And that was the time I decided to open Rasika.
Yeah, now, this is a distinctive approach to Indian cuisine. Now, I expect your first restaurant was probably more traditional, right? And it was, there was upscale always, right?
It is an upscale restaurant. Always have been an upscale restaurant.
That's what you wanted
Bombay
to
Club
do.
Bombay Club was serving regional cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
So food from Goa, food from, you know, Parsi foods, food from the south and north. But what at Rasika, what we did was, you know, when I met with Vikram in London, and he was the executive chef of Bombay Brasserie, and, you know, so we started talking about the concept. And I wanted to take a modern approach in the presentation of the food and using local ingredients. You know, and in between a Bombay Club and Rasika, I had opened 701, which is a modern American cuisine, Oval Room, and then Adeo and Badeo Wine Bar, And, you know, so I have exposure to different cuisines, and I use that knowledge shared with Vikram. Vikram worked in some of my other restaurants before we finalized the menu on Rasika. And that was the approach we wanted to take.
And to you before we came on the air, that listening to the care you took in planning this restaurant, Rasika, is you have hospitality really deeply embedded in your system, in your blood. You asked all the right questions. You approached all the right issues. And I'm not surprised you got it right, which you did.
Well, it's not only about me, and I thank you for your very kind compliments. And I think, you know, Vikram also played a very important role in this. He is equally passionate about the food, and I mean, his standards are very high, which is makes me happy, because on a daily basis, you know, restaurants are busy. His performance never settles. We try to hire the best people we can, and, you know, I couldn't have done it without his help or the team we have built together in the kitchen.
Yeah, so now you built a team. I mean, first of all, I mean, Vikram's talent is apparent even in the recipes, but you
right.
built a team in bringing in more talent even from different parts of India and so forth.
Well, yes. I mean, we have people from, you know, we have very talented chefs. We got, you know, chefs from Bombay come in, chefs from, you know, North has come in, joined us. And, you know, so we have a very good eclectic team in the restaurant. And we have trained lots of local workforce to work in our kitchens too, because we don't have 30 people from India. We only have 2 people who are the chefs from India or London. And, but the remaining workforce is all local. We train them. You know?
Yeah, you really actually answered the question I was going to ask first, which is how many of the kitchen staff have you brought in from India, and you answered that question already. I remember talking to the general manager at Amaya in London, who I'm sure you know. He's a very elegant Sikh gentleman, and he said that one of the things that they decided they would do at Amaya when they opened it was that they would staff the kitchen with people who firsthand understood the cuisine because they were cooking it. And you're saying you went a different direction.
Well, you see, London or England has an advantage on immigration than the United States.
I see,
so
okay.
If you open a restaurant there, they let you bring 4 or 5 chefs from India or whatever country the restaurant is going to be, whether it's Japanese food or, you know, or any other Asian food or Indian food. They allow you to bring people here in the United States. Our immigration system is very difficult and very different. We are not, you know, we need to only can bring highly skilled chefs here and who has degrees and so on. But it's very hard to bring people from India. So we have to rely on the local workforce and train them constantly. And that's what Vikram has done a very good job with the training the local people. But yet, we have, you know, a lot of our chefs are very well trained and been with us for many, 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 many years. So that always helps.
Now, yeah. The other thing that you're doing where London has been a great model for you, I would say, and that is to say, Indian food is not balti. It's not down market food. It's high quality food, beautifully presented in wonderful spaces. And that certainly wasn't true of Indian food in the United States.
No, there were curry houses when you came here. London was like that, too.
Well, I mean, London was like that because, you know, the thought process of eating Indian food was very different, back 30 years ago. But London now has very elegant Indian restaurants, which are as good as, you know, French or Italian or, you know, English restaurants. So when I opened Bombay Club here, my thought process was the same. I wanted to open a very high-end Indian restaurant where Indian Americans could be part of taking their American friends not only to eat Indian food but also to celebrate their birthdays or special occasions or anniversaries or business deals. That was my thought process at the Bombay Club when I opened. Obviously, Indian food is so gaining more popularity in United States, and more people are eating that now.
Well, you take part of the modernization. I mean, this is modern Indian food, and it changes, yeah, and it evolves. I mean, I'm looking through here. All you have to do is look through this, the cookbook that you've produced. I mean, how many Indian restaurants serve a pisco sour? Okay.
You know, true, and that was the whole goal was behind it. You see, we wanted to do a modern Indian take on the food.
Yes.
But keep those traditional flavors in the food.
Yeah, well, you have places to draw on that some people just aren't very familiar with, such as Goa. I mean, I'm looking here at a recipe for calamari,
yes,
which comes from Goa, which was, of course, occupied by, owned, I guess, by the Portuguese.
Portuguese, yes.
For a long time.
Yeah.
This is not fusion food, mind you. This is modernized.
No, it's not fusion food. It's rooted in tradition but presented modernly.
Yeah, I mean, look at this black pepper crab Napoleon with curry oil. Now, that's right to the minute. I'm reading this thing. I want to come there and eat right to the minute.
Yeah, please do. You know, I have Vikram on the phone with you. He can talk you through the recipe.
I'd rather Vikram cook it for me.
Absolutely.
The amazing thing is how colorful everything is.
But Indian food is supposed to be colorful.
Yes,
you know, we use, you know, the spices, the fresh ingredients. Indian food is colorful and it's healthy. If you control, you know, the oil and the cream, you know, which we restrict that in our food. We cook it very in a modern and refined way. That's what the cooking is at Rasikas.
Well, I have to tell you that we interviewed a woman in California, Indian with Indian husband, and she has modified all of the traditional recipes. She claims that she actually... her husband has type 2 diabetes, and she managed to get him off of insulin shots. And she said that India is the diabetes capital of the world.
It is. It's not because you know, in India, we tend to eat, exercise less and eat a little more carbohydrate. You know, and I think the younger generation is getting more educated about that.
Uh-huh.
So, but I agree with the assessment she made. Yes, there are a lot of people in India. They're not big, okay,
no,
but they
diabetes.
But then, you know, but it's the diet which dictates the, you know.
Now, if you were going to pick Vikram, if you were going to pick a recipe from this book that kind of defines your signature approach, what would it be?
Well, there are a lot of dishes on the menu. I mean, if you see the Palak Chaat, which is one of our signature dishes, that's a take on a regular fritter, Indian fritter. But we've just sort of made it more lighter, and it's a fun way to eat crispy spinach.
Uh-huh. Did you say that kale fritters?
You can do, we do kale fritters.
I know,
I'm looking at it. Yeah, well, we're doing kale fritters. It's not in this. No, you're looking at the kale dumplings.
Oh, it's kale
kofta.
It says kale fritters kadi.
Yeah.
And so,
but you can make the palak chaat, which is the spinach chaat, with the same recipes, but you can use kale as well.
I mean, here you're cooking things in banana leaves. Is that?
That's right. The cooking in banana leaves is a very traditional way of cooking in South India.
Is it? Okay.
They do. I mean, the reason you wrap the fish in banana leaves is so that even when you cook it on the griddle, the fish, after it's cooked, it remains very moist.
Yeah, I'm just trying to give people an idea of the sophistication of this cookbook and the recipes and your restaurant. Here I have roasted stuffed dates with saffron chili beurre blanc. Now, that's brilliant.
Well, that was, again, something which Ashok and I were discussing one day, and so he said we should do something with dates and stuffed dates like they do in Italian restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we gave it a different twist by, you know, doing a saffron chili beurre blanc and stuffing it with paneer and goat cheese.
So I own an Italian restaurant, and so I took Vikram there to eat dates, because dates are very popular in India. During the winter time, you see them like on the street side, on the stalls, people having dates in the winter. So I took Vikram to Bibiana. I said, look, they're doing this here. This is how we do it in Italian food. Let's do it in Indian food. So Vikram adopts those things very quickly. And he's gifted in adding the flavors and spices in the food, and that's how that dish came about.
I think he's brilliant. You're lucky you have him.
I'm agreeing with you 100%.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Yeah, and you've got crispy fried onions. That's Peter's favorite dish. Yeah.
Sorry, can I get?
I believe he could make it, I guess. He's good at frying. I'm not a good fryer at all. But, yes, you have all the stuff that is kind of you associate with Indian food, along the spices and stuff. And you were way ahead of the curve on figuring out that it's not a matter of how hot something is. It's a matter of how flavorful, how tasty it is, having to do with flavor rather than heat.
That's correct. I mean, Indian food is not meant to be spicy, that whereas you don't taste the protein or the main ingredient of the dish. It's supposed to be flavorful. I think chili adds flavor to the food, brings the flavor of the dish if it is not, you know, overpowered with it. So, yes, our food is very flavorful.
You should explain to our listeners what the name means.
Of Rasika means flavors.
Uh-huh.
And it's also a very popular name for an Indian female in India. And most importantly, Anne, it sounds good to my ears. So
yeah,
that's why I named the restaurant.
But you said you have to roll the R, you said, in your book.
Yeah, that's correct. Rasika.
Rasika. Oh, it's beautiful. Looking at all these recipes and thinking I'm just starving hungry. If you were a little bit closer, I'd be there for dinner tonight. So, listeners, I think this is a good way to get the character of the traditional dishes in a way that is more sophisticated than what you might encounter when you think you know about Indian food. This explains to you that you probably don't appreciate the really fine sophisticated cuisine if you're not looking for this kind of modernized version. Would you agree? I think that the idea is that it's a sophistication that you're bringing to modern Indian cooking in your restaurants.
Well, we've always based the recipes are very traditional, and as Ashok said earlier, we try and present it in a modern way. So when you eat the food, does remind you of dishes back home.
Uh-huh.
But the food is refined, and it's not overly spiced. And it's, you know, our food is that we showcase the protein in the dish or the main ingredient in the dish, whether it may be eggplant or a black cod or a lamb or a chicken, any dish. So the idea behind is to showcase. And sauces and curries plays very important role in Indian food. Okay, because people like flavorful food. So we have to draw a balance between the dish and the sauce. Okay, so whereas we want to present, the guest should say, I'm eating it, a black cod, he should taste the black cod. But then again, Indians like the sauce more than the protein. So we have to make a balance with dishes. And that's where I think in Rasika, we've done a very good balance presenting our food.
Wow.
Let's just pop in a little example here and see how it came about, because there's a Japanese restaurant called Nobu. Nobu, Mr.
Yeah.
I think it's his first name, isn't it?
Mr.
Nobu made his entire reputation for cooking on black cod.
That's correct. Miso glazed black cod,
which I can make at home. It's really not very complicated. But you took black cod in a different direction with a different flavor component. Why don't you explain how it's different?
Yeah, read out the recipe. Explain the recipe so that they get it.
Well, the black cod, it's a fish from from Alaska.
Yes, yes.
So we took that fish and we wanted to imbibe the traditional tandoori marinating techniques into the fish. So we used things like yogurt, ginger garlic, and then of course we've added a little bit of twist by putting some cream and cheddar cheese in the recipe.
But
the method of marinating is very traditional and we do in tandoori cuisine or tandoori cooking.
But you have a singularly non-Indian liquid component in there called red wine vinegar.
That's right, but normally in tandoori cooking we always have some acid in the form of lemon juice or vinegar.
Okay.
But that could be just distilled vinegar, but we, instead of, because black cod is such a delicate fish, we want to do something more delicate, and so we use red wine vinegar.
Uh-huh. Well, it's extraordinary, the restaurant itself. It's sister restaurant. I guess you need to do a cookbook for that one, too, because it's a separate concept, although there's some overlap. And this cookbook, and you could, oh, I love this cookbook. Thank you so much for talking
to
us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah.
Greatly appreciate that.
And
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So here's once again wishing you a prosperous and a very happy new year in 2018, and we'll see you same time, same place next year. Next year?
No, not but next year. Will be the,
but,
week.
It will be, but it will be the
week.
Same. It'll also be the next year.
Right.
But it'll be same time, same place. So we hope you'll join us then.
Bye-bye.